At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Welcome, everyone, as always, to our November FOMC panel. We've got a lot of things to talk about, especially given the events of the last week, as well as the data that's come out over the last few months. Now, those of you who know how I run these spaces, I like to keep the panels wide open for discussion. So as we go along, panelists, please feel free to add anything you want to any given topic. The only request that I have is that we leave our microphones muted while other speakers are talking, just so we can avoid any overlap or feedback or background noise. So if you have something to add, I'm not going to require that hand raise thing anymore because it seems to be broken 9 times out of 10. So just leave a little breath of air in between the end of a speaker's turn and when you want to chime in. To start us off, we're welcoming back our go-to Fed guy, Joseph Wang. As many of you know, he headed the trading at the Fed's Open Markets desk, has a great introductory book. We always love the plug here on central banking called Central Banking 101. And he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. And he also releases a ton of macro overview videos on his YouTube channel. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be here and glad to be on this panel again. Today we have a lot to talk about. So it's going to be a very, very exciting discussion, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of new factors, I think, that weren't entirely present last time. So I'm pretty excited to get everyone's takes. Next, we've got another friend of our spaces, the last bear standing. He's an expert on markets. He writes about monetary policy and the markets in general on his weekly Substack, which you're not subscribed to. Go do that. A lot of free information, alpha, and feedback can be found in everything. Last Bear, welcome back, Last Bear.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me, as always. It's been a big week, but we still have more to go here, so looking forward to it.
Next, we've got Martin Peltier. He is the portfolio manager at Trivest Wealth Council, an often columnist for the Financial Post, an avid skier, and man, it's nice to have you back with us for FOMC. I always love your takes, man. How you doing?
Good. It's nice to be here, and I'm glad that people are still interested in hearing what we're thinking up in Kanuckistan. So I'm looking forward to participating today.
Hey, Kanuckistan's what it's all about, my friend. Next, we've got Bob Elliott back, another friend of these panels. He's the CIO at Unlimited Funds, the former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of ticker HFND. He brings vast knowledge and non-reactionary takes, which given the last week, I think will be a nice breath of fresh air. Seems like forever since we've had you here, Bob. Welcome back.
Nicholas, thanks so much for having me. I've really missed being on these spaces. Look forward to contributing.
Look forward to hearing your takes, Bob. Thank you. And we'll also be joined, everyone, by another friend of the show, Jem Carson. You all know him, volatility expert, founder of Kai Volatility. Always love getting his takes on the markets, Vanna, Charm, and Flows. So we'll be excited to have him once he's available. So let's dive in. Before we go all the way to the wall here, let's get a quick macro overview since our last FOMC panel. We have a little bit of data here from the month of October. The total non-farm payroll employment was virtually unchanged at 12,000 for the month. The consumer price index rose 0.2% in the month of September, a year-over-year rise of 2.4% versus an expected 2.3%. And of course, the U.S. presidential election has come to a close with Donald Trump as the victor, leading many to wonder what's next for the Fed, the U.S. dollar, as well as taxes and tariffs. So what I want to do is we're going to dive right into the thick of it right off the bat here. Donald Trump has said on more than one occasion that Jerome Powell is gone, should he make his return to the White House. Now that the election is over, do we think Trump will hold true to that statement and replace Jerome Powell? And how much do you think these election results will affect the Fed's rate decision today? I do want everyone to chime in on this one, but let's start with Joseph, then kick it around the panel here.
So, Nicholas, I think you really hit the hammer on the nail here. What is the new Trump administration going to do about the Fed? Now, with respect to the remaining two meetings this year, I don't think it has any effect. I would still expect a rate cut today and a rate cut in December. But looking forward to what the world might look like next year, I think the Fed would really have to be thinking about what the Trump administration is going to do. It's been, I mean, Trump says many things. There is some research that suggests that a Trump administration would have a lot more deficit spending, for example, than a Harris administration. And usually we don't take what politicians say that seriously because they're just campaigning. But the difference now is that Trump basically has a popular mandate. He won the popular vote. Looks like he's going to sweep Congress. And of course, the Republicans also have control over the Supreme Court. So it does seem like there's a potential for big changes in how the country operates. So I think the Fed is probably, that's going to make the Fed a bit more cautious in whether or not to cut rates beyond December, simply because they don't really know how much of what is actually being said is realized. Now, when it comes to the Fed independence, I think that's also a really important point as well. Now, Chair Powell's term doesn't expire until 2026, and you really can't remove a Fed chair unless there's calls. That being said, when you have control of Congress, you can do many things to influence the outcome of the Fed. Well, first off, the Fed, of course, being an unelected body, has to obey the popular will. Not so much you can say by law, but of course, as any public agency knows, you serve the public. And so when they see this kind of outcome, they have to be more mindful of what the executive is thinking. Now, beyond that, though, the Fed, the Trump administration, because it has control of Congress, could really, really shape the Fed. Some easy things they could do, for example, would be to just add more members on the Board of Governors, or kind of like packing the Supreme Court, or they could just explicitly define the Fed's mandate, say inflation targeting to what they want it to be, or they could say, you know, that they could, there's just so many things they could do. They could just honestly make the Fed's life really, really difficult when it comes to their, you know, biannual meetings and so forth. So that is a potential for Congress to, and the Trump administration to have an impact on what the Fed would do. Now, one interesting thing that's been floated around, for example, by one of the potential Treasury secretaries, is even though Chair Powell doesn't expire until 2026, what if they just nominate and approve the next Fed chair right away and have that person be a shadow Fed chair going around giving speeches and influencing the market, even though he's not officially Fed chair, right? So that's just another thing they could do. So there's a whole bunch of things they could do if they want to. So what we want to watch is whether or not the Trump administration is serious about having more influence on the Fed. And personally, I think they are, because the Fed is a very, very powerful government agency. And to be clear, as someone who's worked there personally, they are heavily, heavily Democratic. So I can understand if a Republican administration would like to have more control over it.
Thank you much, Joseph. Now, Martin, you said recently that a Trump win will have an interesting impact on the FOMC meeting. So I'd love your take here as well. What did you mean by that, Martin?
Okay, so human emotion really plays a role in what people think and how they forecast. If you take a look at ahead of the election, the top 10 pundits in the space, pollsters and forecasters, and only 2 out of 10 said that Trump was going to win. And they got it so very wrong. And I think people are going to get it very wrong again. As Joseph mentioned, within the Fed, very Democratic leaning, And so that's going to have an impact on what they do and how they position themselves. And so maybe we get some surprises coming out of the Fed simply because they're jumping to conclusions, allowing their political biases to drive some of their actions. I hope that isn't the case. I hope calmer and cooler heads will prevail, but human emotion does have an impact. You can see it in the markets. You can see it like equity markets, bond markets. And so maybe that will drive what we see today and what we get out of Powell. So certainly it's not something I would discount in regards to future outlook.
Thank you, Martin. Last spare, I'd love your take here as well.
Yeah, sure. So I just actually saw there was a CNN report within the past hour citing some Trump officials saying that they would let Powell serve out the rest of his term, although subject to Trump changing his mind, it says in the article. But I think that there's two different ways to think about this. One is direct, as in, is there going to be something like what Joseph was referencing, where they would literally try to influence the Fed directly. But then there's the secondary indirect perspective, which is that fiscal and monetary policy are sort of a tug and pull, sort of always kind of working either with each other or against each other. And regardless of whether or not Trump makes any changes to the Fed policy, his fiscal policy and his decisions from a legislative perspective may have an impact on what the Fed ultimately does, with respect to how much deficit spending there is, what the impacts of potential tariffs are, et cetera. So I think it does change the landscape. Even if there isn't direct influence, there will be knock-on effects of his fiscal policy that the Fed will have to deal with.
Thank you, Les Bear. Jim, welcome. We're just now getting into the thick of it, discussing how we think the Trump victory in the election will affect Jerome Powell's position and affect the Fed's rate decision today. Do you have anything you wanted to add to that point?
Absolutely. I have a couple thoughts. One, I really see Trump as, again, history rhymes, as a Nixon-like figure. He is Republican in his party and in his broad view, but much like Nixon, he's a pragmatist, and he is he's very much a somebody who's looking to pull the levers of power to help to gain more, to be able to do more, and he's willing to break things and be unconventional in that approach. And in order to do that, Nixon really did institute a ton of populist policy while at the same time, importantly, while pulling the levers of fiscal policy for the popular vote, he also pulled the levers of monetary policy. In major ways. And I expect that, Trump understands the importance and concentration of power that comes with being able to manage and control monetary policy. That is very alluring to somebody who is in that seat and really willing to do whatever it takes to gain more power and make more of an influence. So people respond to incentives, and I find it hard to believe that Trump won't at least try his best to more actively influence the Federal Reserve. Now, whether that means that he will be pulling Powell out of his seat and putting somebody like an Arthur Burns type figure, speaking of Nixon, or finding other means to influence more directly Federal Reserve policy, I feel confident that he will be actively trying to do that. And I think he really, I see him again as coming from Turkey, I have a view of what Erdogan has been able to do. Erdogan, regardless of how you feel about him politically, he engineered, a 15 to 20 year period of dramatic economic growth by really trying to run, by running a very hot demand side economic model while still running a very hot monetary policy. And he was able to do that unlike most emerging markets, due to the external support in the time period he lived in. The U.S. has this exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar that really, you know, gives immense ability to do both of those things and to really export inflation and push, you know, America first policy. And I really think that, that Trump is intent to do that. So this is why you're seeing the yield curve steepening. This is why you're seeing the 10-year move forward. I think you're going to see a very, very activist Fed that really tries to push more economic growth over inflation and drives kind of both sides. So that's how I view it right now. I think the market's also speaking pretty loudly about that. We'll see how he does it, whether Powell has a job or not, I'm not sure. But again, I do expect him to be very, very involved in monetary.
So, Bob, you recently said that the Fed has consistently guided the market toward more dovishness than reality indicates and persistently overstating the downside risks to growth over that time frame. So in addition to kind of your take on the prior question that the panel was kicking around here, can you break that down for us as well?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a really interesting moment because the Fed in this sort of next, let's say, 6 months, is probably not going to be able to be responsive to the likely policy changes that the new administration is going to deliver. And as a result, basically everything is status quo in terms of their behavior, because, you know, the role of the central bank, which Chairman Powell holds, is that you don't respond to prospective fiscal policy. You respond to what you see. And so I think that's pretty interesting because basically what it's going to mean is continued meaningful easing from the Fed over the course of the next, you know, 6 months and running, you know, basically continuing to support what is already a reasonably hot economy. And then you get, you know, 6 months forward and Trump's various policies and influences, you know, will basically put the foot further on the gas. And so I wouldn't expect him to really respond much to the election in the next couple of meetings, even though, you know, markets are likely responding to it. When it comes to the Fed's guidance, I mean, like, look, if you're the Fed, the Fed in September meaningfully changed the reaction function. I think it's important to recognize that Chairman Powell in that moment said two important things. One, inflation is beat, and two, the economy is strong. And with that combination of things, they were going to cut aggressively. And so now with that reaction function change, I think there's probably very little information that is going to change the Fed's mind or the direction of travel of interest rates here at this point, at least in the medium term. I think the big thing I'm looking at in terms of the meeting is, you know, is there anything that's going to change Chairman Powell's view that that cuts are appropriate? I mean, look, since the last meeting, we got stronger growth, you know, absent that sort of goofy employment report, and we got higher inflation than expected. And so the real question is the Fed going to do something about that or not? My guess is it's, you know, the same path ahead that they have been doing, that they indicated in September, and that's, you know, running monetary policy that's over easy.
Thank you, Bob. Jim, I see your hand there.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing there. I think they absolutely, I agree with Bob that they absolutely do not want to make any sharp turns. The last thing they want to be seen as, given what I just talked about before, is somehow reactionary to politics. That said, there is 0% chance that the Federal Reserve isn't watching the long end of the curve and thinking about what's going on here. There's no way that the reactions, which are significant, dramatic in the market, don't play a feedback role into policy. Now, there's no way I would not know way, but highly unlikely that they're going to all of a sudden change their tone dramatically in this, or do something different than what they were, than what was planned. But I would expect December becomes much, much of a different story. I think they have to start like paving the way for thinking about like, hey, if we're going to cut this time and continue doing what we're doing, you know, and if, you know, as part of that, that the market continues to push the 10-year to 5 or even higher, which I don't think is unlikely. I actually think that's my base case, that by the end of the year, the 10-year, along with markets themselves, the yield is higher. And that has, you know, they don't want inflation expectations and long-term yields to go higher for a lot of reasons. So I could see the beginning of laying at least the groundwork for, hey, maybe things will be very different than we had talked about in next meeting. Like, we're data dependent. And then next meeting, if that's the case, really starting to see another pivot. I mean, this is at this point, again, we've talked about this on here as a group. We've been pretty clear about the steepener trade. We have been pretty clear about the inflation trade and the likely resurgence. But this is now transitory 4.0. And I'm not sure at what point the market begins to say, okay, we don't have faith that the Fed is going to be able to hold down along the curve at more medium to long term. That becomes a real self-reinforcing mechanism that I think the Fed has to be a little bit concerned about.
So I think one thing that I'm looking for this meeting is if there's any commentary on when QT will end. Now, if the Fed is concerned about longer dated interest rates, one easy thing they could do is to just end QT sooner than expected. Now, past commentary by Fed officials have suggested that they will let QT go for some time, but there is enough cover in what we see in the markets for them to justify an earlier end to QT. It doesn't have to be, let's say, the long end. It can just be stuff like volatility in the repo markets on quarter ends, and I expect year end as well. Now, this stuff for people in the space, totally normal, not a big deal. But if you wanted to end QT, you could point to this and you could point to the RRP balances going lower and justify it. So I think hopefully someone at the press conference will ask Powell about that.
It's Martin here. Joseph, I'd like to throw something your way. What do you think the Fed cares? I mean, looking at the curve and looking at mortgage rates, for example, in the U.S., mortgage rates have gone from 6.6 up to 7.2%. You know, what is the neutral rate? The market is telling you it's much higher than what the Fed is. Like, does the Fed look at those things? Does the Fed care about the curve itself, and does that influence, like you said, their potential for tightening?
So one direct way that interest rates impact the real economy is, as you suggested, through mortgage rates, and we do see mortgage rates going back above 7% and the housing slowing a lot, and so that's obviously tightening financial conditions and having a real impact on the economy, even as the Fed would like to reduce their level of restriction. So I think that channel could be a problem. Now, you know, but as Jim hinted before, the Fed is, you know, moving the short end, the long end is doing its own thing, many, many potential stories for that. So I'm not sure if the Fed has that much control of it over that, besides from QT and just telegraphing more rate cuts. I think also that, you know, that spread between mortgage rates and the 10-year, that's wide, and probably that has to do with rate fall, and maybe that will also come down a little bit going forward. The neutral rate discussion is something we want to pay attention to as well. So I have a graph, let me see if I can find it, of the FOMC's median neutral rate over the past year or two. And it's really striking that it just goes up and up, because it seems like that the economy just surprises to the upside, even though the Fed thinks they're very restrictive. So I think that has to change their calculus as to how many rate cuts to get the neutral as well. But it's a hard thing to do, because you're toggling this overnight rate, and then other things do have are affected, like, impacted by other factors, and that in turn impacts the economy, and you don't have that much control over all those moving parts, just this narrow corner. And so we'll see what Chair Powell says.
I completely agree with Joseph's point about QT. I think that's a very astute point. And I think that is one thing that I could see them doing relatively quickly or hinting at. And I think that's not as much on people's radars as it should be. I have a question for Joseph, actually. I'd love to hear your thoughts on if the tenure goes, let's say, to 5.25 in the next 2-3 months, what do you think the Fed can do or should do? I guess those are two different things. In order to try and control the longer end of the curve, what do you think they're likely to do? I guess it would be a third question. Just would love to hear your thoughts, having been in that seat, what you think the reaction function would be in that environment.
I think, so we've seen the Fed's tools. They have short-term interest rates and the balance sheet tool. So if rates got too high, I would say it in a couple of ways. Well, first, if longer-term interest rates were too high, I would expect that to be self-correcting, right? You would have people mumbling about recession, and that generates a lot of demand. And usually that recession demand swamps and everything else, and so rates will go back down. But if they really did want to get longer dated yields down, like you suggested, I think it really is ending QT earlier than expected. That's what they could do. But looking beyond that, though, so again, the Fed has their thing, but at the end of the day, they are not subject to elections. The real problem to the government with interest rates that are too high has to do with the White House, the Congress, and so forth, the guys who actually have to face the public. And what we saw last year was one thing that the Treasury could easily do is just massively increase bill issuance, right? We saw the 10-year touch 5%. Then we have Treasury come out and, meaningfully increase the share of bills that they would issue, and things looked much better. And I would expect a new administration to still use those tools and have more of a rationale, more of a reason to do so, simply because they are, the popularly elected government, whereas the Fed is just doing their own thing. So I don't really worry about the long end getting too high. There's a lot of things that are driving it. I think that could, a lot of tools that could be used, and a lot of things happening outside of the world too. I mean, if you're looking at Euroland, or if you're looking at China, globally the US is doing well, but other regions not so much, and that probably, puts downward pressure on US yields as well.
What a discussion, guys. Thank you. This is why I love having all these folks on here, because it makes the host's job really easy when we get these back and forth. So thank you for that, guys. Now, what I want to do next is kind of take a look a little bit closer at the looming question of policy from the Fed, kind of in general, in more of a broad spectrum. And so I'm going to first pick on Bob here and then last Bear. Aside from the election results, there are, again, those looming questions of policy from the Fed. So you've also said, Bob, that there's likely to be more Fed cuts to the tune of 100 bips, and you mentioned in your post on Twitter the other day, or was it yesterday even, that it kind of paves the way for a no landing, the no landing being the clear base for 2025. So, Bob, you mentioned earlier in your take on the first question that the Fed is likely to continue that rate cutting cycle despite the continued economic growth. And you recently discussed this with Gary Bohm on Metals and Miners. So I'm curious if you'd care to take a stab at some of that for us, Bob.
Oh, gosh, you've been catching up on all the things that I'm saying.
I see it all, Bob. I see it all.
I appreciate. I think that the main question from the Fed's perspective, let's say talking over the next 6-ish months before we get to the administration installed and sort of meaningfully up the curve in terms of policy steps, is what are the set of conditions that would be necessary so that they would essentially meaningfully change policy, not tweak policy in terms of maybe cutting a slightly less or slightly more, but meaningfully change policy. And that's where, from what I see in terms of the commentary from Chairman Powell, and the other speakers is, I'd say, almost like a rigidness around what they intend to do, almost to the point of tuning out whatever, you know, data-driven decisions would normally occur. And I think, you know, part of the question is, are we going to see any adjustment in the way that they're thinking about things in response to the data over the last couple of weeks? My guess is that the rhetoric will all be basically down the fairway, the same stuff that we've seen, that we saw in September, just continued. One thing I did want to bring up related to QT is, my guess is I can easily see them thinking about stopping QT. The question there is that good for bonds or bad for bonds? I think is a very interesting question to wrestle with, because the stopping of QT is an effective easing from a quantity perspective. And I know that the Fed doesn't think about it that way. And so that may be a reason why they might slow QT if they see bond yields move up, or stop QT. But given the fact that that's basically less asset sales, I think that's stimulative to the economy, certainly to the financial part of the economy. And that could basically backfire in terms of adding more stimulation to an economy that's already seeing cuts on the short end, and likely to see support from the fiscal side as well.
Thank you, Bob. So let's tickle that topic a little bit. Last bear, what Bob just said there kind of at the end, do you expect a shift in the trajectory of QT should bond yields be spiking? I will say, notably, the 10-year yield did pop quite a bit following the election.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest driver probably to impact, and this is kind of the way that the Fed has talked about QT, has been less to do with long-term yields or the yield curve, and more to do with sort of the ample reserve type regime, where they're looking at the reverse repo facility, they're looking at sort of the leverage in the banking system, and trying to find the level at which, you know, they're trying to bring it down as much as they can without creating an issue. And as they start to feel that they're getting to the point where, let's, you know, the reverse repo facility is down to 150 billion now, down from 2.1 billion a year or two ago. So once that gets down, you know, to the range that we're talking about now, there is, you know, it does loosen their control over the short end. It brings about the potential for some sort of volatility in short-term interest rates and the SOFR market, that sort of thing. And then they're also looking at sort of the reserve balances at banks, which today looks pretty solid, and it's remained pretty consistent over the past year or so. And I think that will be the primary driver. So once they start to feel uncomfortable with how those sort of monetary plumbing type dynamics are working, then I think that'll be the driver. And obviously they already downsized QT by about half earlier this year. I don't know if they would continue to do sort of gradual downsizing or just pausing it altogether. The other thing to consider in this discussion is the fact that the debt ceiling is going to once again become an issue starting at the turn of the calendar year, which ironically will force the Treasury to basically spend its cash balance down, which is currently around $700 billion. That'll be an influx of reserves into the financial system, which you could argue is stimulative, but it also takes some pressure off of the QT discussion as far as ample reserves. And so I think that they, at least what they say publicly, is that, you know, that QT is kind of a separate discussion, and that has more to do with banks and reserves as opposed to sort of targeting yields.
All right, so what I want to do next is I want to take a turn here, and we did just host an Unusual Whales panel on the topic, but it's definitely pertinent information to have as we move forward into 2025 here. So I want to touch a little bit on the topic of tariff changes to come under the Trump administration. Now, Donald Trump has said that he would eliminate income taxes and cover that difference by imposing highly elevated tariffs on imported goods, ranging from 10% for most to 60% to 100% in the case of China. And there are many who have stated that tariffs such as these could actually hurt United States companies rather than prop them up, given the United States' lack of infrastructure to create components of final products, as one example. Now, the 2018 tariffs on steel and aluminum are often cited as a really good example of this, with negative impacts seen on American-made goods, such as the construction industry, the automotive industry. So the question here is, should tariffs be implemented in this fashion? How can these and similar industries offset the potentially elevated costs of imported materials? Joseph, could you start us off on this one?
Yeah, so first off, when it comes to Trump's policies on tariffs, I think we have to be mindful that we just went through an election cycle. So, you know, there's a lot of political talking points on this, some of which are not accurate. So what I would base what I'm saying now is on his interview with Bloomberg News, I think a few weeks back. It was a lengthy interview and was well received, where he gave a pretty candid discussion of how he thinks about this. And so the upshot is that he's not going to impose tariffs. What do I mean? It's a huge negotiating tool. So basically he goes to a country or a company or something like that and says that you will do this. You know, we're buying all this stuff from you. Now I want you to build a factory in America instead of importing all this stuff so that you can create jobs for the US. And if you don't do this, you know, tariffs 100%, you know, maybe 200 or 300%, right? And if you, and that's basically a negotiating tool to get them to come and build in America. So it's not so much policy to that it's actually they want to implement, but it's something that they will use as a way to beat other countries into submission. And if you look at the way the trade flows work globally, the US is a huge consumer market. It's many countries actually have entire national business models geared towards selling to the US consumer. And so that gives the Trump administration leverage to get companies to build factories in the US. If you look historically, you know, the US had the same complaint about Japan. Today, many, many Japanese automakers in the US, particularly in the Southeast. So I think that's what they're trying to do. So if you hear huge, huge tariffs, it's really because they want to have a very, very big stick, not so much that they would like to create a huge depression. But I'll also note that this is probably going to be a disruptive process to global trade. And in the meantime, as they try to transition to their new economic model, it might not be market friendly.
Thank you, Joseph. And I want to continue this vein of conversation here by picking on Jem again. You've said that sectors may see shifts based on outcomes, and there are inflationary pressures that loom due to tariffs and immigration. So it's something I want to kick around the panel a bit. But Jem, can you outline the potential for inflationary pressures should Trump's tariff ideas come to fruition? And as a bit of a tag on here, how do we navigate those potential effects versus the possibly disinflationary factors such as more oil supply?
Yeah, so inflation is not a monolith. We talk about it as one thing, but it has different components, both secular and cyclical components, as well as core, non-core, we've called them. But the reality is different pieces of inflation can be very different in this process. Specifically to your original question, labor inflation, right, is, and things tied to labor inflation are the largest, most secular kind of hotspots that I think will continue to accelerate. Regardless of how you feel about immigration in the last 4 years, it was the release valve on what has been already incredibly hot labor inflation and structural trends that are only accelerating there. Increasing tariffs will only increase those things. But again, if you were to relieve the release valve on the millions of immigration, people coming in across the border and broadly, from other countries as well, you can't close the economic system here and close those release valves and not expect dramatic, I really mean dramatic, labor inflation. Now, we can argue whether labor inflation is good or bad, right? I mean, that's part of the goal, right, is to increase median outcomes. That's what populism is all about. If we're trying to increase median outcomes and have labor take a greater share, domestic labor, gain a greater share of economic growth, you know, you will accomplish those goals. That may be politically popular, regardless of how people largely feel about inflation. If inflation is going to people in the middle, we're rebuilding middle class, maybe that's a good thing. But regardless, that component is not good for profits. You know, I think we're at record margins, right, still or close across the S&P 500. I would expect, you know, policy, protectionist policy, like we're seeing here, you know, isolationism, America first, is really bad for profit margins. So I'd be very much focused on that part of inflation. The commodity piece, I think, is interesting. It's definitely less one directional. I've been very clear for some time, several years now, that the play in energy and commodities, like industrial commodities, is really to sell puts. As much as when volatility initially spiked on those things, these are not things that are likely to go convex, because there's very much a push-pull that happens in these types of environments. One, you have on one end, you do have deglobalization, and obviously China's growth and the emerging market growth has played a huge role in commodity demand, and that is deflationary for commodities at large, right? Global demand is not likely to be higher than it was. That said, you also, in times of deglobalization, get an inefficient flow of commodities across borders. They become a bit of a, everybody's is stockpiling and hoarding commodities in a way to help preserve their strength and their freedom in their countries, right? And that's what we saw in the 60s and 70s. We saw an OPEC crisis. Now, the U.S. Specifically is in a different circumstance than it was in the 60s and 70s. It has dramatic more supply than it needs. But these commodity shortages and their source of power will create dislocations in commodity markets. Even if energy is well supplied, you're likely to see the bludgeon of other commodities, which are not in well supply in certain places, not move it as easily. So I would focus on commodities that are very localized to certain countries, and I would expect those countries to use that competitive advantage against other countries in this type of competitive global environment. I also, tied to that, I would expect geopolitics to continue to. We're not going to have despite what everybody thinks here now, what you're hearing short term from the Putins and the Irans and the Chinas of the world, I don't expect a downtick in global conflict. I think that is, we're in a secularly increasing global conflict time. You can't be increasing tariffs and closing borders and being more isolationist and running a strong dollar, doing all those things, and not expect more global conflict. So I think commodities are more of a push-pull. I'd be selling puts. I still think they have more strength. I know Macau would disagree with me on this, but more strength than weakness. Precious metals, on the other hand, you have to be long convex. Calls on much more strong bullish dynamics, because it's more of a currency dollar as well. These types of things, Bitcoin, are going to continue to move higher. But that's my view from an inflationary perspective. We can speak to housing. That's the other big element. But housing is much more tied to labor and labor strength, and probably interest rates going higher. I do think that'll continue to be an inflationary source of inflation, a structural issue there. Government is going to, regardless of how they feel or what they want to do, they're going to be forced politically to enter that fray. I think Donald Trump expects some big housing policy from Trump. How much of that will be supply side, which is in line with his kind of brand, versus demand side is yet to be understood. But I do think that those are the two areas I would continue to be focused on, both tied to labor and protectionism.
Thank you, Jim. And there's actually a few points there that I'm going to want to follow up on after I pick on Laspierre and Martin here, just again on that topic of tariffs. And then I want to get back to the potential effects of immigration, potential other inflationary aspects that might be coming to fruition. But first, another concern with tariffs is that of trade retaliation, right? That notion that should the United States make it, you know, overly expensive to ship goods and materials to sell in the United States, other countries might respond in kind by imposing tariffs of their own on the U.S., thus reducing access to foreign markets. And so, Laspierre, I'm curious for your perspective here. How much of a concern is that should more tariffs come to fruition?
I think, as Joseph mentioned, that how Trump has talked about it is first as sort of, or as the stick to negotiations. And we obviously need to see how that actually plays out in practice, using tariffs as a threat to sort of renegotiate trade deals, which I think is, you know, sort of what we saw last time around with Trump's presidency. I think total imports to the U.S. is about a little bit in between 10 and 15% of total economy, or total GDP. So obviously there's going to be, to the extent that you have tariffs, you couldn't argue that that's going to be an inflationary impact. I think Sam's point around immigration is also a big one, going from, I think one of the biggest benefits and that partially helps explain the difference between payroll data and sort of household level employment data, which has diverged substantially over the past 2 years, has been a result of the migration, which we don't have firm figures on it, but let's say somewhere around 10 or over 10 million people, which has helped for labor supply issues. If that comes to a halt, or, you know, even reverses with some level of deportation or something like that, you could see that, you know, pressure starting to come back into the labor market. At the same time, we've also, the flip side of that is that, you know, the labor market has been a concern of the Fed, that sort of deteriorating labor demand, sort of normalization of labor demand, is one of the factors that the Fed is concerned about, and markets have been periodically concerned about this year. And so, ironically, maybe the reduction of net immigration helps stabilize that and keeps us on a more steady path as opposed to ongoing deterioration there. Obviously, you know, in the first Trump term, there was tariffs imposed, like, you know, the steel tariffs and others that people mentioned. I don't think that we saw inflation tick up in those periods as a result. But obviously, we're in a different environment now, post-COVID and post, you know, we're definitely in a different world than we were sort of 6 years ago. So I think we need to wait and see, and sort of reserve judgment on inflation, because it's not the only factor at play, right? There's so many different factors, from commodities to labor supply, all those sort of things. So I think it's tough to make a directional perspective on that, or say that that's going to be a, you know, 2 or 3% increase on inflation and totally throw off the Fed's mandate.
Thank you, Laspierre. And you hit on a few points of immigration that I am going to circle back to. But first, Martin, I'm curious for your perspective here as a Canuckistadian, as you said. What could we expect to see in terms of the U.S. neighbors? What should Canada expect, if anything, should the U.S. levy these tariffs?
Well, we have to look at who the U.S., the biggest trading partners are. And Mexico, Canada, and China are the top. And, you know, Mexico and Canada, you know, just because of our location, you know, are the largest exporters. So we had no one's been talking about it, but I'll mention it now. The Canada-U.S.-Mexico trade agreement was done in 2020. You look at, that's coming up in 2026 for renewal here. And what Joseph, going back to what Joseph had said, you know, tariffs being used as a tool or a threat, and that's just straight out of the deal. And you know, we got this agreement done in 2020, and in 4 years, trade between Canada and the U.S. has increased 46%. And so it sounded quite threatening at first. In the end, it actually, you know, doing a deal with Trump for Canada, in the end, it worked out okay for both parties. Now, 77%. Of our exports in Canada go to the U.S. So it's critical for Canada, especially with their economy struggling and being nowhere close to what's happening south of the border in your neck of the woods. So, but what's really interesting and is 30% of those goods exported is energy. And Trump is very pro energy. And one of the first things he did last time he took office was the Keystone Pipeline. Who knows if that's going to get resurrected or not, but you know, certainly the appetite for Canadian type of crude, the heavier crude that we have, is quite strong around the refinery complex. And it was quite insulting, to be perfectly honest, under the previous administration, negotiating with Venezuela to offset Canadian crude with Venezuelan crude. That's done. And so the trade between countries is going to be very important. And I think it'll be a positive resolution, and I'm hoping so anyway, from that perspective. Now, what's really interesting happening up in Canada is there's some big, strong regional politics happening. Our federal government is attacking our own oil industry by putting a production cap, or trying to anyway. We have a minority government with 22% support by Canadians, putting in major economic policy. And that's going to impact the U.S. because, man, if we're going to cap our, if they're going to try and cap our output, and we're a major, and the U.S. depends on our exports for oil, then, you know, that's more of a threat than any tariff per se, and it's coming domestically within our own country. And so there's a lot of moving parts there that probably Americans don't see, but you know, it's causing us a lot of angst up here.
Thank you, Martin. Really good insight there. I'm always curious to kind of see how folks from our neighbors are feeling about what's going on. Because I know the ripple effects can be pretty vast depending on how things go. So thank you for that take, Martin. Now, I want to circle back to something Last Bear was saying on that topic of immigration. Donald Trump's team recently stated that day one following inauguration will carry with it the largest mass deportation of undocumented immigrants in history, which will affect millions of those immigrants. Now, politics and political stances set aside here, what sort of effect could this have on the labor market and on wages, as well as any inflationary or disinflationary aspects to that topic? Bob, could you start us off?
Yeah, for sure. I think this is one of those key moments where you just have to be careful about distinguishing campaign rhetoric, you know, at a rally in, you know, rural Pennsylvania from actual implemented policy decision. And on top of it, how effective that implementation is. And so, look, the big picture is there was a lot of immigration that came in. It was actually quite important in terms of loosening the lower income cohort of the labor market, which had seen the fastest income growth. And that helped slow wages and moderate inflationary pressures in the economy. But really over the last 6 months, because of steps taken by the Biden administration, that flow of people has meaningfully constrained. And so we've been sort of in the new normal here for, you know, about almost 6 months now with lower immigration. And I think in part what we're seeing in some of the labor statistics being a little bit softer in recent months has actually been a function of that, which is the total number of, you know, the total amount of employment is just going to be lower if you have far fewer immigrants coming into the country today than, you know, the 3 million that we had before. You add that all up, you know, probably the Trump administration will continue to pursue the tightened immigration policies of the late Biden administration. Probably it'll be a little bit tighter than that. And so probably what that means is that we'll have less labor, you know, meaningfully less labor supply than we had a few years ago. And that could create upward pressure on wages and slightly slower growth. The idea that we're going to deport millions of unauthorized workers, you know, at the snap of fingers, like that's not going to happen. It's not even clear that the Trump administration wants to do that, particularly if they get any indication that it would be bad for equity markets or growth. And so I'd really caution, and I basically say probably the highest probability outcome is that we essentially get more of what we've seen the last few months and not what's likely, you know, not consistent with the extreme campaign rhetoric that that we saw, you know, late in the campaign.
Beautifully said, Bob. We've got about 6 minutes until we get some data, so I want to kick this one around the panel. Hey, sorry,
can I jump in quickly on that?
Please do, Martin. Hit it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about immigration. you know, we're doing something unprecedented that no other country has done for immigration in Canada. And let's talk about wage growth and immigration, because, I mean, I'm seeing it firsthand up here. If the U.S. did the same level of immigration as Canada in the last couple of years, it's equivalent to the U.S. adding 13 million people a year. So, I mean, let's just really think about that. And so despite our massive immigration, our wage growth was at 4.6% this year, exactly the same as the U.S. So we had multiples higher on a per capita basis of immigration than the U.S. and had exactly the same wage growth. So I think there's some important takeaways there when you're looking at how you're going to deal with illegal immigrants and those sorts of things, because there's no better place to look than what's happening up here.
It's a completely different type of immigration policy, Martin. What you guys are doing is genius, honestly. I wish we did that here in the U.S. It is allowing highly educated people. It is bringing in, granting visas based on qualification.
Well, no, I'll jump in. Like, that actually is not the case. If you look at temporary residents the shift of immigration has been, it's been opened up the floodgates. There's been actually no control over the types and who's coming into the country. And so I'd have to sort of disagree on that, because it's temporary foreign workers, and it's they were brought in and they're working at all of our fast food restaurants, that sort of thing. There's unemployment among the young people. My kid's age, 18 to 24, is at like 30%. There's no work. And so the quality of the immigration coming into Canada is not the narrative that you just spun. It's both.
But I want to be clear. Like, you are Canada is currently bringing in about twice the number of H-1B equivalent that the U.S. is currently, and you're obviously 1/15th of the size.
Yeah.
So that part of that part is actually not necessary. That's pro growth. That rises. You know, that's good for growth. Period. That doesn't necessarily lower wages. That type of immigration, but it is very, very pro growth and brings expertise. Well, the other end, you know, there's probably some. You know, I assume that there's some truth to that too.
But on the growth side, our GDP per capita is declined for five straight quarters. And over the previous year, it's down by 2.2%. If you look at Canadians in general, if we had matched the U.S. growth, our economy would be 8.5% larger today. So as a result, we're worse off by $6,200 per annual income per Canadian over since 2015-16. So economically, we're on a per capita basis among the worst in the OECD. And immigration is not providing an economic driver as what we're being told. And so this is a major contentious issue up in Canada. Our economy is just doing so poorly and it's contracting on a per capita basis. We're not seeing any benefit to the massive amount of immigration. At the same time, the resources being placed on the provinces, we have a housing crisis and an affordability crisis that's unmatched anywhere else other than Australia maybe. And so there's no housing. You need an average income of $200,000 Canadian to buy a home in Canada, to buy an average home just to qualify. And you get taxed at the highest rate at 55%. $248,000. All your benefits get cut off at $90,000 a year. So we have a real crisis in Canada. And so I would be looking at Canada and saying, what's happening up here? We do not want that happening down there.
Yeah, immigration is, since time incarnate, you can go back probably 50,000 years. Like it is the boogeyman of politics. People always point to immigration as people. Those people are stealing our jobs. They are causing economic growth problems. If you look at the actual data, that cannot be further from the truth. I'll say that as a broad generalization. The growth issues in Canada are not tied to the increase in immigration, regardless of how you may feel. The issues there are tied to much more nuanced things like capital flows, currency issues. And again, as you mentioned, there's all kinds of structural supply issues that also exist. But we can agree to disagree. That's what makes a market and a good discussion. Appreciate the commentary.
I could not have loved that discussion more. I love getting various takes and perspectives.
Joseph, on the 25 basis point cut, what are your thoughts so far?
Well, this is broadly expected. So market is pricing in this. So I don't think it's a surprise to anyone. I would focus, and of course, I'm looking for a red line for the statement, but I don't think.
It doesn't look too much different here. I mean,
yeah,
risks to employment inflation are roughly in balance, right? That's basically attentive to both sides of the dual mandate.
Yeah, really want to see the press conference, right?
Yeah, I mean, this like, it looks like they kind of mailed it in terms of the statement. Oh, here we go. Martin, thank you for sending through the.
Also on the immigration thing, you know, Bob, like Bob mentioned, a lot of this is campaign stuff. It's really hard to know what's going to actually happen. I mean, Trump went on the All In podcast and he's like, if you graduate from a U.S. college, I want to let you work here. And that made everyone's eyes light up on that podcast, but then that's a lot of people that would be coming into that country. In fact, I think in Canada, for example, they have something comparable where you graduate from a Canadian university, you get to work there. And so,
I think that's a good example that speaks to the fact that it's campaign rhetoric. It's like on the All In podcast, he's saying we want to hire, you know, college graduates from elite American universities, and you know, who's the audience of the All In podcast versus, you know, campaign rally in rural Pennsylvania, and let's say the language is different, right? And more than anything, you know, he's shown that he knows how to meet the audience that is in front of him. And so that's why you just have to be super careful about translating rhetoric into policy.
And I'm looking at the data from the election. It looks like the Latinos broke for Trump in a pretty big way, especially the Latino men. You know, maybe that changes how he thinks about this as well.
All right, I want to touch a little bit more on that topic of immigration and kind of spinning it back to, you know, potential strains that can occur. Fed chair did note that immigration could indeed strain specific communities like Springfield, for example, on an array of fronts, from housing to healthcare, as they kind of absorb new residents into these cities, especially when, quote, they contribute to an already tight housing market. And I have some questions about housing specifically, but Joseph, could you give us some of your take there?
So Martin would be the master on this. I've seen that data in Canada where you increase the population and rents go to the moon. So yeah, it puts a significant strain on housing and downward pressure on wages. So I think it's understandable where a lot of people would see their rent go up and their wages go down and would be unhappy about this. So I think that's a legitimate concern. And maybe it is good for growth, as Jed mentioned, but I think it's also, looking across the world, pretty unpopular as well. Now, one other thing that I would note is that it's you know, if we have fewer migration, it's probably going to be inflationary because wages will go up. But there are two ways that could resolve. We could have higher wages and then the companies raise their prices, go into a wage price spiral, bad for inflation. Or we could have higher wages. Companies have lower profit margins, right? So the companies eat the cost. And so the workers benefit, companies make less money. So that's also possible. That's actually what's happening in the Euroland right now, actually. There's a pretty good presentation on that I saw recently from the ECB, whereas the increases in labor costs there have largely come at the expense of profit margins. Now, if you look at the US, profit margins are pretty good. Companies are making a lot of money. So if we have the competition policy right, that is also a possible outcome where we could have more people, but also be it not inflationary. So we could get growth and not huge inflation.
So Martin, he did mention you, and I think I agree with him. Do you have something you want to add to any of Joseph's thoughts there?
Yeah. So just for some context, I'm very much pro-immigration. Absolutely. And especially in a country like Canada, where we need to grow our population. But the way it was done, it's the cold, hard truth is it was done with under guidance of McKinsey Group and a fellow by the name of Barton. And it was done in a way that it opened up the floodgates with zero to little screening being done as to who's coming in and how are they coming in. I would meet people, for example, from India playing basketball in the park, and we're playing basketball, and they're like, "How'd you? What's going on? What's your story?" And they're like, "Well, you know, we came in, we paid $30,000 to $40,000 a year to get into some community college, which may or may not, you know, actually do any actually college work." As a means of buying their way into the country and in buying properties, driving up rents and overall costs. And so if you look at the main argument, looking at who's supporting who, we have a very young demographic grouping that voted for the extreme left Trudeau. And now they're actually going to the right with Pierre Poilievre. And they've completely shifted over because they're looking at their lives and saying it's a lot worse off than it has been. And I think the same thing happened in the U.S. And that was underestimated, that people are looking at, maybe it was the African-American vote, Latino vote, different groupings. But they said our life has been worse off the last 4 years. We're not better off. Our cost of living is that much. And in Canada, there's, like I had mentioned, the unemployment rate among young people is astronomical. It's quite high. And you can't find a job as a young person to pay your way to go to university, let alone even get into university, because there's no spots. And so, like, just honestly think about it. If you let 13 million people in the country, unchecked about where they're going to come into, it's going to create some challenges. And so, having immigration being a topic among young people or disenfranchised people is one that's worth having without placing the blame. And so that will drive policy. And it's just something to consider. I mean, definitely take a look at what's happening up here before you do anything and just say, okay, how do we take a measured approach? How do we do things like they did in Canada, but much better, and find out the failings? Because there's a lot of failings that have happened.
Beautifully said, Martin. Thank you. What I want to do next, we've got 22-ish minutes before Jerome gives his presser on the FOMC decision. I want to kick some stuff around in relation to equities and the markets at large. I'm sure a lot of listeners here would love to hear some of this, so I definitely want to touch it. I'm going to start here with you, Lasbear. In your recent publication, quote, "The Volatility Divergence," you mention that while equity and indices are not perfectly negatively correlated, this level of what you said was extended divergence is rare, citing 3 months of consistently higher stocks and consistently higher implied volatility. Can you break down what that means for us a bit today, Lasbear, and maybe touch on, as you put it, why now, when actual realized volatility remains low and equities are trading near highs?
Yeah, so I think we already kind of had the firm answer. Deeper in the article, I kind of come to the conclusion that a lot of it is likely election-related sort of uncertainty. And obviously, you know, with a decisive election result on Tuesday night, We saw the VIX and all sorts of implied volatility could get crushed, which was a lot of people would say that that was a consensus perspective, but obviously it still happened in exactly the way that one might expect. So coming into the election, we had actually really low realized volatility on a backwards looking basis, but all sort of measures of implied volatility and tail risk were quite high. And a lot of the rally that I think we've seen, especially on Wednesday in the pre-market and just throughout the day, obviously some of that might be a perspective on Trump. A lot of that also is just election uncertainty wearing off, implied volatility is getting crushed. And obviously the impact of that is a sort of a boon to stock prices. So I think that was a lot of event risk that had kind of gotten baked into the market over the past month or two. And we've seen that wear off and seen the benefit already in equities.
And I think kind of as we came into and post the election, a lot of those concerns might have been quelled a little bit, because one of the main concerns that were being voiced was that if, for example, yields continued to rise, stocks would begin to roll over a bit. And following the election, the equities markets obviously did seem to kind of blow off the top there. We've got all-time highs almost across the board. And so, Bob, to continue on this, you recently posted that the markets were pricing in a Goldilocks scenario of strong growth, easy monetary and fiscal policy, and low inflation pressures. You followed that up to say that there's no real reason to begin legging into new positions quite yet. So I'm wondering, Bob, could you walk us through that? What are you seeing in equities as of now?
Well, I think we're in a period of policy uncertainty, and I think a lot of the itch is to start making bets rather than sit on your hands and recognize that you gotta learn a little more about the various policy measures that are likely to occur. And I think today kind of wraps that up by seeing whether or not Chairman Powell endorses the continuation of cuts and over easy monetary policy, despite, the higher than expected inflation numbers and the stronger than expected growth numbers that we've seen. And so my guess is, and I'm generally leaning towards the story where over easy monetary policy will persist, and that will be further enhanced by easy fiscal policy in the second half of 2025. Which would put you in a position where, you'd really want to be back to being long stocks and gold relative to bonds. Even though, when you look at stocks and gold, the prices are high, but the momentum is pretty strong. And I think probably one last thing that may reinforce this through the end of the year is there's a lot of people who've been positioned quite conservatively through the, through the course of the year, given this uncertainty. I can speak from experience in terms of our measures of hedge fund exposure. There are a lot of funds that are still underweight equity risk, or were as of a couple of days ago, and that, they've underperformed relative to the indexes, either explicitly or implicitly, and that, we could easily see a situation where, professional managers have a bit of a FOMO catch-up trade here through the end of the year, given the set of circumstances that we're seeing, which would, bring forward those positive equity gains. That's kind of the combination of things that I'm seeing right now.
Thank you, Bob. Let's tickle a little bit more on what you said about gold, because you had noted in the past gold is really holding in there considering the substantial rise in the long end. And so I kind of want to follow up on gold here a little bit with you, Last Bear. What are your thoughts on gold now? We've got a little bit of a pullback from its highs going into and following the election. Is that seemingly endless series of ever new all-time highs over? What do you expect from gold?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I don't know that I have a firm market prediction on gold, but I do think that gold responds quite well to easing monetary policy, which continues to be the case. Obviously, we saw that yet again today. And I think we should expect to continue to see rate cuts coming forward. And if we're talking about sort of the Goldilocks scenario that Bob laid out, if you have a situation where you see stock prices and asset prices more broadly continuing to benefit from an economy that's remained intact and fiscal policy that's quite strong and monetary policy that is only easing, then it's a supportive backdrop. Obviously, we've seen gold go from 2,000 to 2,700 over the past year or so. That's been quite the run. I don't know that it, you know, how whether it'll be as a vertical of an ascent from here, but I do think broadly that gold benefits from the same sort of asset price inflation dynamics that we see in other assets. I know that there's a chart that was going around recently that showed the total return of, not total return actually, but just price return of gold versus price return of the S&P 500. Obviously that doesn't include dividends and reinvestment and whatever, but that those are basically matched from when, you know, we broke the gold standard in the early 70s to today. And I think that obviously some people don't like that comparison, but I think that there is some merit to the fact that when you have sort of hard assets, whether it be real estate or stocks or gold, they sort of benefit from the same sort of tailwinds. So that's sort of my perspective on gold, but obviously also recognize that the, you know, precious metals more broadly, silver, gold have done quite well so far this year. And I wouldn't be surprised, particularly if we continue to see pressure on the long end from rates, that those gains become a little more muted.
Thank you, Last Bear. Bob, comments there before I move on to Martin?
Well, I think that on gold, I just, it's so many people are focused on the price. Like, well, the price is high, and that synthesis that Last Bear just said, which is, it's not exactly right, but basically, I mean, it's not on a total return basis, it's not exactly the same, but there's a case for, you know, gold has done pretty darn well over, you know, 1, 3, 5, 10, 20 and 50 year time frames in terms of being a complementary asset to a portfolio. And here's the simple reality: is nobody holds any gold. You know, 95%+ of advisor-directed investment accounts have literally zero gold, and of those that do, the average is like less than 1%. And so it just doesn't. And at the same time, bonds are sucking wind, and have been for several years. It would not take that much reallocation or inspiration, let's say, to improve diversification in portfolios to keep that bid under gold. And in that sense, gold is like a very different asset than stocks because, you know, essentially everyone's exposure to stocks is at all-time highs. It could be good, you know, I think there's good reason in the future why it might be, you know, the economy or the environment might be supportive to stocks, but people's exposure to gold is de minimis. And so two very different assets from a sort of strategic allocation perspective.
Beautifully said. And since you mentioned it, I do want to touch a little bit on that market participation at all-time highs, while again, equities are also very much at all-time highs in many cases. So this will be probably our last question before the presser, because I think it's going to be a nice long discussion depending. And if not, don't worry, I got more. But Martin, you recently wrote in Financial Post about hedging against this euphoric phase in the markets where growth expectations are at all-time highs with valuations close behind. And you noted that investors as a whole don't seem terribly concerned with this. You noted that, quote, "We've learned that when very few expect anything to go wrong, something usually does. And when it happens, it can have an outsized impact on the market." So as a two-parter here, Martin, first, are valuations indeed too high and a market-wide pullback or correction on the horizon? And second, how do investors hedge their positions should the euphoria, as you put it, rapidly dwindle?
Wow. Okay. That's a good one. So that was right before the election, and so I've kind of tempered my response, my view a little bit on that. So I'm not as bearish per se. There's so many canaries that I saw in the coal mine that were flashing warning signs, and then we have an outcome that we saw this week that is going to be inflationary and bullish for the markets, and not so good for fixed income. And so what do investors need to do? And I agree with Bob. I think we're going to see a lot of FOMO chasing going into the Santa Claus rally per se into December. A lot of fund managers, it's called career risk. If you don't match or beat your benchmark, you're going to lose clients. We do goals-based investing. So our benchmark is what is specific to each client, not having to outperform NVIDIA or NASDAQ or whatever the case may be. Now, having said that, households hold 48% of their assets in equities. That's the highest since the 2000 dot-com bubble. And if you look at the last 12 months, all of the global fund flows have gone entirely into just one sector, tech. Traders have also built the largest U.S. equity futures position in history, according to Goldman Sachs. And then one stock, NVIDIA, is a quarter of the S&P 500. So when you take a look at that, flow it into households, you have one stock driving 11% of household gains. That's crazy. I mean, I've never seen that before. Maybe I'm just old school. I'm Gen X, not a boomer. But I mean, this is really, really interesting. And so I'm like, well, you know, if you've made some good gains in the markets, then, you know, look at doing some hedging. And the cost of putting in some put protection on your portfolio, that'll be a drag on future returns. But you made a hell of a year. I mean, you had one of the best years ever in U.S. equities. So why not just, you know, put some downside protection into place and look at just protecting some of those gains. We do like U.S. dollars. We think that's going to go higher. I mean, that's good for us as a Canadian. We can do more and more U.S. dollars. And then we're looking at alternatives. I know Bob's done some good work on that. But, you know, looking at some alternative strategies to the U.S. and equity markets. And so, yeah, I think there's some room here. I've changed my tune a little bit. I think there's some room to run in equities, U.S. equities in particular. You can see that by the move post Trump election. But is it going to kick off things like we saw the last time he won? Well, it's a much different scenario in today's environment than when he was last elected. And so I am being a little bit more cautious about positioning. And so if you why not just, you know, take off some of those gains and do a little bit of hedging. You've done well, and enjoy your Christmas dinner without having to, you know, worry about what's going to happen in January, February.
I love that take. You never go broke taking profits. And I will preach that until the day I die. Bob, I see your hand. I don't know if it's an old one or not, but regardless, I do want your take here as well. What are you seeing in equities as we kind of move forward with these all-time highs just getting cracked in the face?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is while you never get poor taking profits, your ego can get bruised when your crazy uncle is killing you all in on NVIDIA, right? That's the challenge.
That's awesome. That is so good.
and I think, you know, from an asset manager's perspective, I think if this is, you know, I talked to a lot of investment advisors. I talked to a lot of asset managers in my day job. And I mean, to a T, everyone I talk to is basically like, yeah, I'm having a pretty good year, except it's not as good as the index. And when you have times like that, the FOMO trade becomes strong. It doesn't mean that it can't, you know, go badly. But I think the thing that sets up the optimal FOMO trade is trailing performance, easy liquidity, strong growth relative to what's expected. And a short calendar ahead, which will inspire people to move quickly. And you know, we're seeing that set of conditions basically line up here. And, you know, the valuations part, of course, stocks are at very elevated, you know, are at elevated valuations, but if you, you know, they can go higher. That's the thing about stocks is, you know, the valuations, just like Canadian houses, the valuation in stocks can go, they can go higher, much higher than maybe people expect, and can get disconnected from sort of longer term fundamentals.
And we do have, you know, endless examples of, you know, death by a thousand cuts when people try to time the top with shorts, you know, like, and so that kind of brings me to the next question. And I'll spin this one to last bear on this same topic. How do you think bears are feeling right now? Are you know, retail or institutional, are they trying to call a top anytime soon, or are bears kind of hands off? And the last bear standing himself might even take a seat.
Oh yeah, well, I've just for the record, I know that despite the name, if you follow my Substack, you'll know that I've been very positive on stocks for past 18 months or so. So it's I'll just put that caveat in there. But
for sure,
I don't think that there's a lot of there's certainly not a vocal component of people. I think that obviously there's people who are upset with valuations. There's people who are upset that they've underperformed or missed certain trades. But at least at this point, I don't see a big chorus of people who are really, you know, seriously and putting money behind trades that are betting on the downside. And even if you look at, you know, we're talking about hedging, I think, you know, if you wanted to, it's cheaper now, you know, in the past 3 days to hedge than it has been for much of the past 3 months. I would also point out that, you know, we have kind of gone through a back and forth on the growth narrative in the past 6 months or so. The summer sort of brought about some growth scares with weak labor reports. And then those seem to all pretty much flip, except for the most recent BLS report. But flipped quite positively in the past couple months. And so those fears have temporarily subsided, and you see, you know, yields obviously increasing on the long end as a result. But we'll have to continue to see, whether that was just sort of the natural variation in a couple months worth of data, or whether we actually are at an inflection point where we could see some sort of actual fundamentally stronger growth as opposed to solid but maybe slowly declining growth. So I guess to answer the question, I don't see a lot of bearish sentiment out there. I don't know that that's necessarily the best indication for whether or not you should be bullish or bearish stocks, but for right now, it's not what I see.
And you did actually echo something that Martin wrote in that exact same pre-election article, that part of the opinion hasn't seemed to shifted, that hey, edges are cheap right now. Where's the damage in locking in and protecting some of those gains? I do like that sentiment a lot. Bob, did you have anything to add there before we get to J-PAL?
Yeah, the only thing I'd add is that when people are thinking about bubbles and the timing of bubbles, the thing that determines the popping of the bubble in almost all circumstances, I've spent more of my life studying these things than I care to admit, is you have to have tight money in order to create a turn in the financial markets and start to deflate a bubble. And we're not close to that right now. And that's all there is to it. And so, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of people holding their nose, both from a political perspective, as well as from a valuations perspective, and, you know, likely smashing the buy button here through the end of the year.
That's awesome. That couldn't have said any better. It's so true.
Yeah, I don't think I have a whole lot to add there as well. And you guys know that I'm pretty much always going to defer the folks on the panel on most of these topics. I'm just some guy who likes options flow, you know? I mean, everybody, thank you for coming and listening today. Obviously, thank you to our panelists. If you're not following them or paying attention to their publications, you definitely should. These guys have so much to share and teach, and obviously we have a lot to learn about
macroeconomic climate and how things are looking moving forward.